exciting new job.
Yes. They're making him do actual work now.
Yeah, it's rotten. Bloody hard work as well, to be fair.
Oh, no. Don't they know you did the module for White Hack?
Hi, this is Steve, aka @AllUnthar on Twitter, and here are some more of my gaming vexes.
Subcommittee Room XCOM 9895, Wing 5, Interagency Liaison Committee. Secure compartmentalized information, code word access only. 9th July 1967. Location, Temporary Field Office, Washington, D.C. Present, S.A. William Kincaid, current assignment, FBI. D.D. Alexander Rakochi, current assignment, FBI. Also present, Laura Austin, stenographer, current assignment, redacted. Meeting began. 11:21 a.m.
Okay, Bill, let's pick up the pace.
Redacted.
It's on my ass to get this review done ASAP. They're itching to start operation.
Redacted.
But need our input before they give it the green light.
They better hold their horses, Alex. If Camellia has anything to add to their knowledge, then we should damn well listen.
Okay, Bill, I get it. Let's just see if we can wrap this up. So, Weismuller's staking out the girlfriend's apartment.
Hetty Mason.
Okay, Hetty Mason. Meanwhile, Holly and Kara are over at Slim Charles's place, right?
Yeah, Weissmuller calls in. He's shaky and disorientated from seeing that horrible little...
Redacted.
But Wyatt had just reported for duty, so I sent him right out there. Ordered Weissmuller back to base to get some rest.
How was he?
Wyatt called in to say when she got there, he's settled enough to drive at least, but still didn't seem quite right. You know how it goes, Alex. Sometimes seeing this stuff, if you're not used to it, it can really spook you.
I hardly remember those days.
Me neither. Anyway, when Weissmuller comes in, I sent him to the doc to check him out, but... he's happy and no need to send him to the...
redacted.
Just yet.
What's going down at the apartment?
Carter and Holly are sitting tight, but Wyatt just goes right in. Combination of an understandably poor handover from Weissmuller and our own take-no-shit attitude.
Okay, how'd you get past the super?
Wyatt turns out to be quite the black bag artist. Pulls out some pics and walks through the door to the building and the apartment as if they're not there. She thinks straight away, flat, iron, smell of blood, and lots of it is stinking out the hallway. She pulls a piece and carries out a textbook kick and clear. Hetty Mason dead in the main room, Slim Charles laying on the bed, but this is heavy shit. Wyatt pulls in a call to Carter and Weissmuller, and they lead footed across the town while she carries out the preliminaries.
Heavy shit?
Sure, Mason's got multiple stab wounds. Head, neck, face, eyes gouged, blood everywhere, Charles is lying on the bed. His body is mummified, skin and muscle shriveled, as brown as hardened wood. Wyatt gets the chills, but swallows it, she's tough as they come.
Redacted.
Sure, look that way, but Wyatt's got no knowledge of that at this point. She gets the camera out and starts taking the scene. Carter and Holly show up and they start a fingertip crawl of the place. The identical calendar is present, the mirrors have been smashed, and there's a drug paraphernalia around the place as well. It's a phone message for Charles that Hetty must have taken down. It's from Big W, unknown number. There's no sign of any codebook.
Okay, what about Charles? Signs of drug use?
Hard to say because of the condition of the body, but Wyatt took a close look and then things go sideways. Charles' eyes flick open.
Shit, he's alive? Impossible.
This episode, Andrew, Kay, Neil and I look back over a truly memorable campaign of Kenneth Hyde's Fall of Delta Green, published by Pelgrane Press, which is run by the inimitable Martin at mcookie123 over a period of almost 2 years in real time. The story started with a group of mismatched agents, new to Delta Green, with a variety of checkered pasts, investigating the proliferation of a new narcotic, adding even more tension to the pressure cooker environment of Alabama in the early 60s. Uncovering the horrible intent behind this conspiracy and getting a sense of the hypergeometric nature of the threat, agents Wyatt, Kay, Carter, Andrew, Holly, Neil, and Weissmuller, me, turned the focus of their investigation to Las Vegas and the Nevada desert. Here they became embroiled in the sleaze that underpinned the glamour of the thriving casino culture. Here too, they discovered the links to ancient myths that seemed to point to a plot to open a portal to somewhere else. Desperate to thwart whatever insane plans the conspiracy had, the team moved to Vietnam in the early days of American involvement. Finally, the stress of the investigation took its toll, and Weissmuller succumbed to a parasitic plant infection, to be replaced by the dangerously curious Dr. Marc Beauvoir. In the company of a unit of US Marines, the team tracked the conspiracy to its heart at a French colonial rubber plantation. During this part of the story, White and Holly met their end, but the remaining agents and the Marine comrades saw the plot destroyed, once and for all, maybe. The game was fantastic fun for all concerned, and not only because of the intricate plotting that Martin delivered week in, week out. To deliver this gaming experience, Martin did a huge, in capital letters, amount of research, and it showed in the depth of immersion we were able to achieve even whilst playing remotely. In addition, Martin created amazing write-ups in the form of after-action debriefs, like the one you just heard, ably performed by Andrew and Neil, and letters home from Kay's other character, the down-to-earth Marine Chip. You'll hear more from him later. Before we get into our discussion, just a word of warning. Being a game based on the Cthulhu mythos, there are lots of references to mental health issues in the context of tabletop RPGs. We also discussed the fates of our characters in the game, one of whom committed an act of fatal self-harm as a result of exposure to mythos entities. With that in mind, on with the discussion. Get ready. So should we get into the main event then?
Okay.
So we're gathered here to talk about, I think we all agree, one of the very best campaigns that we've ever played in. So it's a campaign of Pelgrane Press's Fall of Delta Green. We've got Martin, who was the games master. We've got Kay, we've got Andrew, we've got Neil, and you'll have heard some of the case notes that Martin brilliantly wrote sort of to outline the start of the campaign, ably performed by Andrew and Neil. I'll let you guess who was playing who. So Martin, over to you.
Before we sort of met up this evening, one of the things Steve, you posed me as a question was, why Fall of Delta Green? Why that set? Like, Cthulhu has always been my thing, I guess. I like investigative scenarios. I like writing them. I like playing them. I like reading them. So, like, having an investigative scenario was always, you know, is what I enjoy most. I'd never, up at that point, when I started thinking about this, like, I hadn't really had any experience of Gumshoe as a system. And I think Gumshoe isn't as intuitive as other systems in some ways.
Well, we played the Judge Dredd thing,
exactly.
Okay, which was sort of Gumshoe, but not really.
I thought that was an inspired mashup, Gumshoe and Judge Dredd. I thought it fitted really well. And I would say that was what modelled Gumshoe for me and gave me the confidence to have a go at Fall of Delta Green, really. And the other thing was, like, at the time, I was living in kind of the arse end of rural Belgium.
You were.
I was a bit of Billy No Mates because, like, all my work colleagues lived in Luxembourg. So I had plenty of time in the evening to kind of to think about stuff and write stuff. That helped as well. So the setting, why I chose the 60s. So I've always liked America. I've always been a bit of a Yankophile. So I like America, the cultural sort of background of that 60s America. So child of the 80s, like many of us. And I think cultural touch points like MASH, like, and then like if you grew up more or less the same time as I did. So by the time you're in your like late teens, you hit that kind of wave of Vietnam films.
Oh, yeah.
Platoon, Full Metal Jacket.
Yeah, Hamburger Hill.
Hamburger Hill, sort of slightly lesser known one. I don't know if anyone's ever seen 84C Charlie Mopic.
No, I haven't come across that one.
If you can find it, it's excellent. Highly recommended.
Right, okay.
And also coming along in the 90s, I really got into James Ellroy as a writer.
Okay.
So he had his LA Quartet, which was like the 50s. And then he started on the American Underworld sequence, which started with American Tabloid. And I would still say American Tabloid is one of the best books I've ever read. Ellroy's an acquired taste, but I've acquired it. His ability to plot is just outstanding. And then this whole vision he has of this very sleazy America, that really sort of lent it to that period as well. Mm. And then on top of that, I suppose you've got your American paranoid cinema. So Manchurian Candidate, Parallax View. And then even some of like occult stuff, like Satanic Rites of Dracula, where Dracula's at the height, there's a conspiracy. I mean, I know we're getting a bit Knights Black Agents.
I've got to say, Martin, if somebody said to me, why did you choose to run Fall of Delta Green? I'll say it's because I like the picture on the front of the book. That would have been the level that I would have come at it from. Not the really deeply thought out, you know, how it's almost like built into your soul, isn't it?
Maybe. I mean, I suppose this is all post hoc rationalization to some extent, in that it probably says more about my slightly obsessive reading habits. Because at the same time, you've got there's a whole sequence of books about Vietnam. So the things they carried, Tim O'Brien, I think is just an outstanding book. And that actually gets a name check in Full of Delta Green.
Mm.
But there's, Meditations in Green, which is quite a fantastical view.
The setting was tailor-made for you, wasn't it, really?
Yeah, I think so. And the other thing, of course, is I like real life settings. I like history. The frustrated historian in me loved the research, and I like bringing in real life people into scenarios. So that's why you rub shoulders with Martin Luther King and Howard Hughes and Robert Mayhew, like real life CIA sleazebag fixer.
Yeah.
You know, all these people existed in this kind of slightly complex period in American history. So that was all great as well.
I think from my perspective, I mean, the amount of preparation, I mean, I hear you talking now, obviously, you know, you'd sort of absorbed a lot of this stuff anyway. So it's almost like it was in there ready to come out. But the level of details, you always had fantastic sort of period pictures, sort of, you know, newspaper clippings, etc., that really started to set the scene.
I mean, definitely. Unlike Martin, I live with my head in the clouds and stuff like fantasy and so on. You know, the real world's far too scary. Give me orcs and dragons any day. And so it was great to dig into it, really. And I think particularly the Vietnam section was actually quite educational for me. Stuff I'd just never really thought about or appreciated. And so, you know, I think the teacher in Martin, if you like cut him in half, like pedagogue or something like that, big letters. And
that's pedagogue, everybody. Pedagogue, thank you.
And so I think that like right from the offset, set from when I first became involved, I remember, I think I missed the first one or two sessions. And so there was like a backlog of case notes, files on some of the young men who'd been murdered. There was just a load of stuff. And that continued throughout, just a real grounded, you felt like you were, you know, you felt like you were an investigator because you had to really pay attention.
Yeah.
You know, the handouts. I mean, when there was handouts, it was like handouts plural in the biggest way you can possibly imagine. You know, it was never like here's a handout with a diagram. It's like here's five or six, you know. And it was brilliant because, you know, it really dragged you in, and we were all theorizing and trying to work out what was going on. Yeah, it was fantastic. I love that side of it.
I mean, in terms of detail, I love the race relations in Alabama, you know, where kind of get involved with Martin Luther King and that whole kind of, I got the impression you'd really researched that, Martin. That was really powerful, you know, really spoke to us, you know. I mean, obviously we're all kind of middle-aged white people, you know. So
Yeah, I think one of the problems that you have is setting in the 60s, and I had, and I know we talked about it. Like openly as well, was that you have to walk that line between trying to be historically true to the setting, but without using the frankly degrading
racist language. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah,
that was used, and I felt that very keenly doing the Vietnam stuff because it's like researching Saigon. So I was on Google Translate using it to translate Vietnamese names.
Yeah.
To say, you know, because I don't want to just make myself look like an idiot by like westernizing their name, the names I was using. So, so that was a kind of a line you had to kind of
I thought you were incredibly sympathetic all the way through. I thought it was really, really well played in terms of dealing with non-Western culture, you know, or even as I said, kind of racism. You know, I thought it was. Really...
But you're right though. I mean, you know, we did discuss that early on in terms of how we're going to do it, and I think we sort of. We didn't call it lines and veils, but I mean, essentially we said, well, you know, this stuff happened, and we sort of drew a veil over a lot of it, really. Yeah. But I suppose that's the challenge of, you know, near modern settings, because it's dealing with, okay, it's a game about tentacled beasties sort of ripping people apart and all that sort of stuff. But, you know, it's based in living memory. for a lot of people.
And, and I think if those horror games are to work, it's got to be the mundane. The horror comes out of something that's quite mundane. And if you're trying to portray it as something mundane, you've got, there are the pitfalls of how real do you want to get, because there are some horrible things that happen. So you have to, I think, and I think, like you said, we all sort of treated it sort of seriously, which has really helped.
I think everyone's kind of said what I was going to say, really. I've written down as actually the constant fear of that social breakdown that was in the background of our investigations, particularly when we were in the in the American South and the Martin Luther King era, was part of what made it really scary, because it was, you knew that at any point you could go and do something stupid as a player character, and that it would kick off this powder keg of racial tension. And we did have, you know, we had some characters in there that were part of the Klan, NPCs, I hasten to add. But, you know, we had some Klan characters, and we had some proper neo-Nazi characters, and just plain old Nazis. And it was really sensitive to actually take on that kind of social responsibility for that setting, knowing that Martin, being so true to history, I don't think at any point any of us players thought we could do some stupid idiot stuff and get away with it. You know, we had to treat it with a lot of respect, and I think the respect with which everybody treated it was absolutely brilliant and made it as impactful as it was.
Yeah, it was great. And I think because, you know, we were, as you say, we none of us gave into the temptation to sort of whip out a shotgun and start blowing people away. Well, obviously only when it's entirely appropriate to do
until
so.
Until they clearly identify themselves.
Absolutely. You know, because we were living with, or the characters we were, you know, playing with were living within real life structures. So, as you said, the Klan were there, and they were really dangerous brutes. And so we had to be quite careful not to get on the, you know, to expose ourselves to them, because they were just a curb stomped us, basically. I think as well, a Yankophile, you called it, that really came through. I mean, certainly in the Las Vegas segment. So we had three segments. So we had sort of Deep South, Birmingham, Alabama. We had Vegas and Nevada and that whole sort of desert sequence, which was, that was dreamlike. That was, it was, it was really trippy. We doing that. And then we sort of transitioned into the Vietnam side of things. But the fact that you'd been to spent quite a bit of time in Las Vegas, and you were saying, oh, I've been to that. So we were talking to them about these hotels and casinos. I've been there. I've done that. This is what I know. And actually, there were little Easter eggs that came out, and I could sense. I mean, we were all, well, I was unfamiliar, and Neil said that, you know, we learned a lot as well. I'm not sure about Kay and Andrew's sort of predilection for gambling in Las Vegas. Who knows what that could be?
I've never been to Las Vegas, but I would love to.
It's my dirty secret. I absolutely love Las Vegas. In many ways, it's a ghastly place. It's a great place to visit.
I'm not the biggest lover of pop culture, but I can kind of see the appeal. You know, it's a
very otherworldly place, because I only spent like literally 2 days in Vegas on a work trip to Los Angeles, and it was just me and my boss. So most of the time, I let my boss do his thing. He's like, "Are you going to go around Vegas with your boss?" No, you're going to go around Vegas on your own. So I went around Vegas on my own for 2 days, and I was very much an outsider and looking at it from quite a distance. But the game that we played, and certainly the sort of 60s Vegas that Martin had put together, was so rich. And it was really great after this seriousness of Alabama for the characters to go and play a little bit. And we did. I thought it was really nice how as player characters, we were very serious and very kind of job orientated in that first season. Then went and played loads and did all kinds of crazy stuff because we just could in that second season. And then in the third season, as we went to Vietnam, you know, the midden was hitting the windmill at that point. And there was, you know, all of our stability was in the toilet. And some of us were already on second player characters, which I'm sure we'll get to. So by then, you know, the stakes were very high, but Vegas was such a playground in every possible sense. And I think that's just what made it absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, I think that really came through with me as a GM. So your players, your characters really sort of bought into that. Can I flip it over and ask you guys, what were your highlights as player characters, do you think?
For me, it was, you talked about the deep seriousness of the first season when we were in Deep South. But actually, we did form an impromptu jazz quartet when we were trying to infiltrate a club, which I think was pretty cool. And so then you work out, why have I got 6 points in piano or whatever it is on your character sheet, because you'll never use it again. So that was brilliant.
Yeah.
But I liked the all the stuff you brought in about Native American legends. in I thought that was amazing.
Oh, yeah, Nevada, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And sort of as an observer, because I wasn't directly involved with this, watching Wyatt and Holly when they're sort of infiltrating the upper reaches of a hotel, going after somebody they thought was a vampire.
We thought it was a vampire, yeah.
Which was Howard Hughes, I seem to recall. Yes. And we just tied ourselves in knots.
He's a terrifying vampire. I love you.
It was an old guy with long fingernails. It wasn't a vampire at all.
Yeah.
So that was amazing. I mean, the other one, I mean, there's so many amazing. We were playing it for almost 2 years. Mm-hmm. But when we were in Vietnam and player characters decided they weren't going to infiltrate the temple with the evil dudes in it, and we just said, no, we're not going in there. But we played it anyway. We played it as though we were a group of Vietnamese police.
Yes.
And so we quickly just made up some characters off the top of our heads. And we all, as we went into this temple, I mean, listeners, it didn't end well for this group of police, unfortunately. But we created like family links and, oh, by the way, my character is going to get married next week. We knew they weren't going to get that far. So it just, on impromptu. I love that. That was brilliant.
Yeah, that was fantastic. Because that, I mean, that literally was me just, I had to make that up virtually on the fly. Because you decided there's no way we're going into that cultist compound. Let's get the Vietnamese police to do it.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, yeah, brave Americans. given that was pretty much made up on the fly with lots of like consensual sort of world building, that was brilliant. Really enjoyed that.
That was fantastic.
At the time, it didn't feel like a highlight. It felt a bit secret pants. But looking
it was
back,
brilliant.
It was great, yeah.
Yeah. Although my character wasn't directly involved, the Howard Hughes moment was my favourite of the entire thing. I think it was just the way that Holly and Wyatt just got so focused on the fact they were dealing with this vampire.
because we talked ourselves into it. This was the thing,
we'd taken
on disguises and we'd snuck upstairs to the penthouse. Yeah. And by this point, you know, everything in the narrative was saying vampire.
Yeah.
And there's this recluse. And he doesn't really have anything. He doesn't eat anything. Although, Martin, because you were very...
Ice cream
was in there because your research was so good. Yeah. But then it was like, you know, there's a knock on the door and the hand comes out and it's this time. And we were like, ah! And talking of scary, it was just... I think we actually ran away.
You ran back to the scary.
The characters ran away and it was all in our own minds. And if that isn't Delta Green...
That was brilliant. That was my absolute favourite moment of the entire. I mean, I loved all of it, but that for me was an absolute highlight.
I think the whole Vegas thing with the, you know, the gangsters and the casinos, it was just so much fun. And, you know, when there was that place where we trailed the there was a few of them and you were going to bump some fella off. We were like sneaking around outside some great set pieces, really.
And the mining thing as well, where we just we went down and then discovered all the fields of weird plants and we basically just bombed the hell out of it. Yeah. grabbed as much TNT as was available and sent it down the lift and just blew everything up.
So that's one thing I wrote down as one of my highlights was it was when you cornered the scientists who were working, making that supposed combat drug.
Yeah.
And they were quite open about it. And they said, well, we're testing it on, the black population of Alabama because black soldiers are going to be the majority of the draft in Vietnam. So, you know, we've got to know it worked. And Holly just didn't even let them finish. Started smashing their faces.
I love that. Yeah.
And I really, because that was like the scientists going, well, we're only obeying orders.
Yeah.
And Holly sort of going, I'm not having that. Not only did you smash their faces in, you then blew them up and buried them. So, you know.
Dynamite galore. Yeah,
I think that was a fairly sort of a full stop on their little plotting. I thought that was great.
Shit is alive. Impossible.
Maybe, maybe not. We've seen this before.
Redacted.
All the team have to take deep breaths, but they're up to this. They try talking to Charles, but his eyes are crazy, flickering all over the room. Unfocused. He's in bad shape.
No shit.
Carter sees that one of Charles' fingers is slowly tapping. Even though it must be virtually solid, he's somehow summoning the effort. It's Morse code, and Holly and Carter decipher it. Kill me. Over and over. They try to get something else out of him, but no dice. Wyatt goes to call an ambulance. Carter takes a more direct approach and smothers Charles with a pillow.
Christ.
Yeah, but Alex, wouldn't you want a guy like Carter around if you were in a similar fix?
How'd Carter cope with that?
In a way that suggests he'd done a certain amount of wet work for the company in his time.
Figures.
I pick up Wyatt's call on the police van and head up there myself. Figuring the circumstances, the team needs some reassurance. I also want to make sure Charles' body gets nowhere near a redneck autopsy by some gorilla with a bone saw. That thing needs to be secured and sent to...
Redacted.
ASAP.
So, we still have it?
Sure. Might be worth checking out the egghead sound...
Redacted.
...yourself. They could have found something useful for this new operation. Anyway, I checked on my team, secured the body, and encouraged them to follow any leads. Not that they needed that encouragement. Holly already got the bureau to give them an address for the number Big W was using. And that had linked to Big W's friend, Reggie. Looked like Reggie was a Reginald Hitchcock, a schoolteacher living in a predominantly white neighborhood in the east of the city.
Okay, so how does it go with this Reggie guy?
Team pull up to Reggie's house. Wyatt and Holly go to the front door to brace him. Carter goes around the back. SOP all the way. Wyatt and Holly see Reggie. He's coming off antsy, sweating, stalling. They hear a door slam. Big W rubs out the back and Carter's on him. There's a backyard chase through hedges, folding fences, but Carter tackles the runner, cuffs him, brings him back to the house. By this point, Wyatt and Holly have got Reggie cuffed too.
Finally, face to face with Big W. He spill?
Not initially. He was scared. Seems he'd been braced by some Air Force guy at his apartment. Must have gone rough for him as he hightailed it to Reggie's.
Carpenter? Or whoever he was?
Sure. Description's Matt, so at this point, Carter and...
Redacted.
...still in play. Holly and Carter double-team Big W with Wyatt playing observer. They reassure him they're not with Carpenter and get him pumping for info about the drugs. Big W explains the setup. Slim Charles was a connection that he and the other two...
Sharp and Hunter.
Right. But they met in the slammer a few months after they were up. Charles says he's got some good connect to some premium dope coming into Birmingham. Sharp and Hunter are all over it. Big W less so. But he's trying to get a stash together to open his own business or some such. So he's in too. They have one meeting with a connect. Big W names the connectors LT. Big W says he's one scary son of a bitch. Hang on, I've got Wyatt's verbatim here. Creepy man, like focused and in the game, but real creepy. Like he could look right through you. He knew things, man. About all of us. Things he shouldn't have known. Definitely a soldier, man. For sure. He didn't know Alabama, though. Some out-of-town guy.
LT?
No, LT. As in lieutenant. Fits from being a soldier and all.
This is telling Carpenter in the Air Force. Military off the book shit.
I think at this point you can infer that. LT was backed up by some armed heavy guys, according to Big W. But there was more. Big W says that... Meet he got to look at an LT's car. Back to Wyatt's notes. You're going to think I'm crazy, man, but when we went to the trunk of his car, I would swear the car was empty, but as we walked away with our package, I looked back and there was something looking at me. Couldn't swear whether it was man or animal. I got to look at flashing eyes, sharp teeth. Freaked me out, man. None of you ever saw it.
Okay, so that fits with
Redacted.
Sure, it's all coming together, isn't it?
Okay, what else did he give?
He talks the team through the calendars, a simple way of indicating the streets for drops. And he decodes the book that they picked up in Slim Charles' apartment. It's basically instructions for selling the heroin. Not for sale to whites, keep it to known users. There's also instructions for arranging a drop, including the phone number. Highly check the number, but it's unlisted.
Big W cracks it open, huh?
There's still a lot of stuff in the wind at this point, but yeah, the team felt they got a line of things. I wait for them to debrief me and appraise me of the next step.
Okay, that's a neat place to finish. And it's almost lunch. Wednesday's spaghetti day. I say we go off the steak instead.
You said the magic words.
Don't even joke about magic, Bill. Get your jacket.
Meeting suspended, 12:56.
I mean, related to that, I think just the bit, the kind of games I love anyway, the dungeony bits. So, like, the warehouse in Alabama, just so atmospheric. And, you know, as we're going through...
The little cho-cho in the air con and stuff.
Well, there was that. And then there was, you know, all the passageway off to the side with all the, like, the jungle-like vegetation. Yeah. And the office with all those, you know, again, a massive amount of clues. And then there was, obviously, the mines in Nevada as well, which were fantastic. And then in Vietnam, there was, I'd say, the alien site, you know, that was kind of underground. And we found all that weird stuff there. Just every time we went into something that felt like a dungeon, it was just like my old school dungeon crawling.
The catacombs in Nevada, we might have made effective use of the fog of war on Roll20, you know, and we were. I think there was Carter and Holly back to back, kind of making their way around this.
Yeah. Oh yes, that was my deliberate attempt to make sand dwellers scary again.
Yeah,
one of the most maligned Cthulhu monsters, sand dwellers, always pathetic. So I thought, come on, let's make sand dwellers like bad.
Yes, it worked. Yeah, it's genuinely.
So I quite scary, like that. Yeah,
I mean, you talked obviously about your interest in the whole period from a history perspective, and so much of it seemed pre-planned. So I just wonder to what extent you had an arc in mind and how much of it was emergent. I mean, I think in any long-term game there will be an element of, you know, the GM riffs off the players and vice versa.
So I suppose the most honest answer is yes and no, in that so the whole thing started because I bought the Fuller Delta Green book, and the idea was I was going to set up a team to then play through the Borellus connection, which was going to be published quite soon after, but you know, it's been delays and stuff, and so that still isn't out. I thought, that's fine. I'll have a couple of scenarios, build up a team, and then we'll do this published campaign. But when I got the Fuller Delta Green book, the scenario in that was about, it was about a team that was already established. So I don't want that. So I'm going to write my own introductory scenario where people get drawn into Delta Green. So I thought, well, I'll write Alabama's always, that sort of era has always kind of interested me. So I thought, I'll write one in Alabama. Then we'll just jump straight to the scenario in the Fuller Delta Green core rule book. And then that'll be that. But because like the Borellus Connection publication was delayed, I kind of had to make it up. So I knew I wanted to end in Vietnam, and I knew I wanted to start in Alabama. And then I thought, well, I really like Las Vegas. 60s Las Vegas is just like right for doing something with. So I thought we'll do that. So there was a kind of arc, and I had the same big, I always wanted the same big bad. So I wanted the great god Gatanothawa, and I fancied the idea of there being a conflict between him and the Maigo. So you could bring that in. But other than that, it was like, there wasn't like a complicated story arc. The season themselves were quite tightly scripted in terms of flow charts and stuff, murder boards, whatever you want to call them. But the overall arc, that was less solid in my mind. It grew more solid as we went along, I think. Like some things, because you guys, you went and did your own thing. So you dodged, I thought, I've written it down somewhere.
I wrote down
how in every season there was at least two branches where you took like a road I wasn't necessarily thinking you would. I think in Vegas you just didn't go into the final temple. You just went, I'm not going in there. And so it's like, oh right, okay.
That's because we just fought our way past the sand dwellers and we're absolutely terrified.
Yeah.
We're just getting hell out.
So that was a kind of and the other big one was in the final episode, basically. I'd done all the lead up to get you to the cave. You got right to the edge of the cave and you're gonna go in the cave, and then you just thought, do you know what? Let's not go in this cave. And that
yeah, too damn scary.
The thing was, I thought, when I was writing it, I thought, well, they're not going to go in the cave, are they? That's mad, because like they've been warned off it, so surely they won't go. And then at the end of the like penultimate session, you all agreed, let's go down the cave. So that 2 weeks was fairly hectic for me, because I had to create this whole sort of cave complex, which I did, and thought, well, this will work, and this will work, and this will work. And then you bloody sods, you didn't go down the cave.
You shouldn't have had such a terrifying kind of gate guardian. Then we would have
I just misjudged it, really. Anyway, but it was great fun, because you know, we had
a passing vine, probably gone in, but kind of like vines that formed into a face of.
Yeah. I think that was like in my mind, it was like, we're going to go somewhere and, you know, we'll be able to undo, you know, this connection in some way in this cave system. But when we got there, and then it was it wasn't the lieutenant, was it? It was the other fella.
Colonel.
Yeah.
And he was kind of saying, you know, it doesn't matter. Well, or was he trying to invite us inside?
He wanted you to go in the cave. And so that's, yeah.
Yeah. And that's when I started thinking, All done.
Yeah, exactly. When you get invited into a cave by a kind of terrifying plant kernel face, you're like, actually, this probably isn't a good idea.
Because you made the choice about like plan A or plan B sort of thing. You made that choice when you dealt with the MIGO and said, well, now we don't want your deal. We're going to do it ourselves.
We don't want to live in tubes the rest of our eternity.
You don't want to live in tubes. I mean, honestly, you've got no sense of adventure.
For eternity, yeah.
That's a kind of downside, though, isn't it, of having that balance of fear and how far you can push your players before they get really risk-averse. Because I think that the whole sort of cycle that we had was that we'd get all of this sort of vast amounts of info and sort of sleuthing, and then things would slowly get more and more paranoid, and the paranoia would just build and build until there was a moment of extreme violence and high jeopardy. But because, you know, to sort of, I guess, let off a bit of steam kind of narratively, and it worked really well as that sort of game cycle as well, because that meant that, you know, Neil got his dungeons essentially, and Andrew got to smite things every now and then in really kind of sudden ways. But it did mean, I guess, that sometimes when the paranoia had built so much that we ended up doing things that you hadn't anticipated as a GM. Because, you know, our stability was so low, and we became very risk-averse as players.
That's it. I think in some ways the paranoia actually peaked with the MIGO. You know, it was almost like once we decided we weren't going to take the MIGO's offer and kind of engage them in a fight, you know, after that, we kind of knew what we had to do and we were going to kind of go and do it. There was the slight diversion with the cave with Weissmuller. You know, Carter was like, maybe Weissmuller isn't on their side. Maybe there is something, you know, and then as soon as he got to the cave, he was like, actually, this doesn't look right. You know.
So in terms of like fear in a role-playing game, I think that's one of the things about a horror game, isn't it? Is can you actually feel fear? I don't know that I have ever felt like genuinely afraid of a tabletop role-playing game. I've certainly felt uneasy and creeped out.
It kind of depends on what level. I mean, if you're feeling about fear of your character dying or something happening to them, then, you know, obviously Neil doesn't do this because, you know, he's used to old school essentials where everybody has a new character every 2 hours anyway. For me, there was definitely genuine fear that my character would, something would happen to them. You know, I mean, as it turned out, I was the only one of the original team to survive, which is a combination of luck and God knows what else. But as you say, with the sand devils, I mean, that, you know, making our way around a labyrinth, you know, in the dark with these sand devils coming out the walls was pretty genuinely.
I think there was a lot of, there were moments where there was a real sense of tension. And, you know, and I would never say as a player I was in fear of my character dying, because that generally doesn't bother me.
Yeah,
the sensation you're talking about, Martin, I have felt that. I remember the first time I played Call of Cthulhu. This is probably like 1983 or something like that, and played that haunted house scenario in the Corbett House, and I can so clearly remember that sensation of the unknown, and it isn't fear. It's not because you're in a set. You're in a safe space. You know, you're sitting with your friends somewhere safe, so you don't feel fear in that sense, but you do get unnerved, and there's like a chill in your spine, and you know, your legs can feel a bit like jelly and whatever, and it's almost like you don't want to, you know, as it, like, the game demands you continue and explore and put your characters beyond, but your instincts are no, but you also have this like perverse curiosity that you want to find out. And I think when it gets, you kind of get that mixture just right. It really is a fantastic thing about games. And I think there were a few times when we had that in this game. I think the one that stands out to me was we were talking about the in Nevada, in the mines and so on. And we got right to the back and we found Carpenter, you know, chains, and he kind of like, he completely seen too much. He just like flipped and whatever. And there was that weird pool, but there was a room beyond. And we were kind of like, we so wanted to go there, but we so didn't. And there was kind of like tension. And you're like, we're all kind of like, are we going to do it? Are we? And the way you'd set it up was brilliant. It was just like, because he was saying things to us like, you know, you mustn't go that way. And, you know, if you go that way, but like, we're thinking, yeah, but it was game, as you're thinking, there might be something there. We got to, and there were a few moments like that where it was just that really nailed it, I would say.
one of the things I noticed was, I mean, I've played with you guys in quite a lot of different games, and I say that there's generally quite a lot of levity between the players. You know, people make jokes and comments and stuff. And I say that there was definitely, I mean, there was some of that in Nevada, in Las Vegas, particularly in Las Vegas. But I'd say, you know, certainly for Alabama and particularly Vietnam, I noticed that the level of levity just dropped.
People
were taking it much more seriously. Mm. You know, there didn't seem an opportunity to make that facetious comment.
Yeah, there was the one that I think really stood out to me was when we first went into the jungle, because there was such anticipation for going into the jungle, you know, for like literally about 8 sessions, I'd written down, we're going to the jungle this session. and we didn't, because there
are
was...
Are so you much... trying to say my pacing was off, Kay?
Not even. It's just there was so much to unpick. And I think, you know, by this point, I'd already made... We knew we were going to go to the jungle. We knew we were going to have to make some secondary kind of grunt characters. And I had already made Chip. Chip came together so quickly for me, like literally in about 20 minutes. I knew exactly who he was. And I really wanted to play him. So there was that kind of getting to the jungle. And then we finally got to the jungle after this huge build-up. And you put in that audio, some audio, and you had that animalistic baying of was it the Champa? Is that who it was?
The Chocho. No, it's the Chocho.
That was the bestial Chocho. The bestial Chocho.
That was actually, that's the sound of a howler monkey.
Yeah. And that's probably why that went straight to my hindbrain, because I absolutely hate monkeys. I do. I find them to be horrible parodies of humanity. They're right in the uncanny valley for me. So any kind of monkey noises are just horrible. But I think it's partly because you'd built it up, and I'd been building it up in my mind that I couldn't wait to get this new character out into the jungle. And I just thought, son of a bitch, I've been waiting to play him for 6 weeks, and he's going to die in the first 20 minutes. In the very first jungle encounter, it's going to be him. But you use that audio to such great effect. And I think that, you know, considering that your storytelling style is very visual with sort of maps and handouts, to have that audio element and to bring it in so rarely... You know, it was only used maybe sort of 2 or 3 times, I think, throughout the whole of these campaigns, that when you did use it, it had a massive impact. And
that was a lot of fun messing around, because, I mean, it was my first real experience of using Foundry, GM. It was a lot of fun trying to work my way around Foundry. It's got a lot of features that are really good at getting an atmosphere going. And so that was very good.
Can I chuck in?
Yeah, please, chuck in whatever you like.
With Kay talking about, you know, the creation of Chip, the kind of the concept, and I'm thinking about my Marine, who was created way back when we were in Nevada, and we had some goons that we needed picture, and I used some of my, is it network or contact?
Networking,
and I created this guy who is, so my character at the time, Dwight Holly, had been in Korea, and you know, he was kind of experienced soldier, and he had this contact, and it was Marvin Lee Mad Dog
Hancock.
And this guy was just like, he lived in a caravan in the middle of just outside Las Vegas. It's like battered, run down caravan. He's the kind of guy who you wouldn't want to meet on a dark, lonely night or anything like that. And we took him out there, and he was like, yeah, I'll take care of these for you and all this kind of stuff. He shared a few beers and then shot the bottles from a range and all that kind of stuff, you know. And when we kind of, like, you know, that bit of the game is over, I didn't really give him much thought again. But then when it turned out we were going to have to create our party to go into the jungle, it seemed like he'd come out of retirement and sign up again. And it was great.
That's very good.
Somebody who started out as my contact and came into the game.
I think the soldiers are great like that. I mean, it's like with Prof, you know, because Carter was so kind of straight and, you know, straight kind of cool, and, you know, he was professional kind of assassin, you know. I thought, well, when I have a soldier, I'm going to go for somebody who's completely kind of nuts, you know, the guy who's basically been conscripted despite the fact that he's not a soldier at all. He's just some kind of weirdo. He's
good. I mean, and I think like that I suppose one of the things that was an unintended consequence of the soldiers being created quite quickly as a kind of secondary character was, I suppose, if you're going to be meta about it, they were like more expendable. They were like,
soldiers.
They were, you know, they were put into a position where they didn't really understand what was going on and just had to sort of like figure out themselves and try and stay together. And so I thought, even though I had no real reason to expect that would happen, it did, and I thought it was really good. Like, and I think I speak for us all when I say how much I grew to really like Chip.
Yeah. Chip was brilliant. Yeah.
Well, Chip was just so fantastic because things were going so difficult with Linda Wyatt, my main character. And by this, you know, by the time Chip was created, and he is Chip Kowalski, because all of my characters, I think now, if I can create a Kowalski, I will do. but you know, he was the antithesis of Linda Wyatt, and I'd gone really, really deep into her characterization, particularly sort of through Vegas and then coming into Vietnam. And it was great for me because I've never been able to play a character for that long. It's the longest character that I've ever role played by far. And I got so deep into her backstory, and you were starting to sort of weave it in into the other stories, and everything was falling apart. And she was falling apart. And then there was Chip. And Chip was this simple, wholesome white bread loaf in, you know, a whole mess of everything kind of going wrong. There was a little Chip. And you could, big old Chip, because he's a big boy.
Big unit.
But, you know, you could rely on Chip. And things with Chip were always really simple, even when they weren't. And it was just such a real nice juxtaposition to all of that complexity that was going on in the story to have a character. And I must confess, by the time we got to sort of the end of Vietnam, and I'd missed a couple of sessions, and I must confess that my understanding of the story was starting to unravel. It was really nice to be able to play Chip and go, well, if Chip wouldn't understand it, so if I as a player have got a bit lost in the narrative, that doesn't matter because Chip wouldn't know anyway. So it was quite a nice safety valve, I think, for me as a player as well.
It's definitely Billy Bob Walton, wasn't he, Chip?
Billy Bob Walton with a machine gun.
Yeah.
With an M14. Yeah, absolutely. You know, asking Sarge, what do we do now, Sarge?
One of the other things,
I actually found that gun, though. I thought it was funny how Steve's gun obsession just got more and more throughout as the campaign went on.
What were my biggest challenges as a GM? I would say, I think I've already talked about them, really. Well, one of the main ones was like that kind of line between historical accuracy and kind of the changing times and sort of sensibilities. I think case notes. Writing the case notes was a challenge.
Hi, Mom. Hi, Pop. These letters are going to seem mighty strange to you, I know. They're getting to be like those weird tales books Uncle Howie used to read before he had to go upstate. But I'm only writing the truth of what I seen, Mom. You didn't raise Chip to be no liar. So I'm sitting on a porch outside of this half-brick, half-wood plantation owner's house. There's a lamp to write by, and there's bugs hitting it at top speed, flashing themselves or dropping to the ground. They ain't like any bugs I seen, though, Pop. Too many legs, I reckon, even for bugs. Last time I wrote, I said that one of our civilians, Dead-Eyed Carter, he got talking to a mirror. Well, that carried on for a while. He seemed to be listening to replies and answering back like I was only hearing one side of a phone call. There's a lot of things said that I couldn't follow, but I'm pretty sure that whoever Carter thought was in the mirror was an old buddy of his or something. Like I say, weird tales. Well, whoever Carter thought he was talking to was encouraging him to find a cave and then come through, and if he did that, then he would see the world differently and live forever and whatnot. Sounded an awful lot like that man in the mask was jawing on about until the crab parrot showed up and started frying everything. Carter stood there a while, so the Sarge had us recce the place and secure a perimeter. The master bedroom was all smashed up, looked like something had come out of the jungle and came in through the glass window. Nothing looked to be missing, although there was a piece of cloth caught on the glass. It was real soft and reminded me of when I was little and used to have that toy bear that Grandma Joanna brought me all the way from Poland. Next was an office, and Sarge got real interested in that. Found some journal from the director of the plantation, Boucher, who it seems pretty much flattened the village of some nasty natives, but they didn't go far, like there wasn't something sacred to them near that plantation. He also mentioned this plant scientist guy, Chastain, who was wandering off into the jungle. Frenchie got real excited about this, and so did Sarge. I reckon Sarge is red hot to avenge his buddy that he got himself blown up by the crab parrots. We also found a woman who had gotten herself hidden in a wardrobe. She seemed real shaken and hadn't eaten for what must have been ages, because she ate our MREs like they were fried chicken or steak. She told us the plantation was attacked by some giant animal, and a lot of the native workers ran into the forest, and the guards tried to fight whatever it was, but lost. That explains all the bullet casings everywhere, I guess. Lafleur, that was the woman's name, real pretty, was some sort of scientist and told us about how Chastain was getting more and more interested in the weird plants and trees that seemed to grow around the plantation. That's why he kept going into the jungle, she said. Anyways, we set up claymores in defensive positions and set a watch and slept through, and I tell you, Mum, for the first time in a long time, I slept in a proper bed with a proper pillow. It was so soft and warm, made me think of home, and I guess I must have cried, because when I woke up, the pillow was all wet.
Can I ask you what your, did you have a system or a method? Because it's quite a complex undertaking to, you know, to have those case notes and to make sure that they are, like, valuable in that they push us in different directions.
I mean, basically, I just try and take notes down as we play. The conceit was it was somebody, you know, it was reviewing what you were doing 4 years after it happened. That made it quite easy to kind of weave it together in a way. It was easier than trying to do it contemporaneously, as it were. So every case notes were just like in the present tense. It was actually quite easy to do it in the past tense. Obviously, in the early case notes, I hid everything that was sinister by saying redacted. And as we got kind of, as the case notes started to kind of get more complicated and you'd done more of the adventure work, it just became much easier to do it in a past tense. So I didn't have any sort of groundbreaking system, just kind of taking notes. And then I'd miss stuff out as well. I tell you what was a big help. I don't know how everyone else does this, but when you're writing case notes, the Roll 20 and Foundry, the record of dice rolls is just vital.
Yes.
You can suddenly scroll back up and think, what actually did happen? And you can scroll back up and you can play out the whole scene by a sequence of dice rolls. And it triggers your memory. So that was really helpful. But yeah, other than that, it was just like, it got out of control. So it was never meant to be this longer campaign. So it became quite a challenge. I think the system was a challenge. Don't get me wrong. I am broadly in favor of Gumshoe as a system. I think the reason I like it is that if you want to keep the narrative moving, it works really well. Easy to find clues, easy to propel characters in the direction they want to go by giving them the clues. I think where Gumshoe struggles is in a complicated high-tech environment like the Vietnam War and complicated weapons and all that kind of stuff. Hanging so many tactical decisions off a single D6 roll necessitates lots of different modifiers and lots of different rules. And I just couldn't keep them all in my head.
But I think one of the interesting things about the combat system is that you're penalised in terms of sanity for actually killing anything that's human. You know, I just thought was quite an interesting, because obviously, you know, in those case notes you read out, Carter effectively smothered someone who was still alive. And I remember having to make a sand roll for that. You know, that's despite the fact that Carter is a professional assassin, effectively.
Yeah, that's right. So
whatever the equivalent of American of a license to kill is, you know,
The idea that, I mean, you know, it's Fall of Delta Green at its heart is an attritional system. You are not meant to survive.
No.
At least not all your stability intact.
I do love the clue system. I do love the fact that clues are thrown at you. You know, you don't have to worry about the whole failing forward thing. You know, you don't have to worry about the fact I failed the library use role. So I'm, you know, so somehow the GM's got to give me this clue, but with a penalty. You know, I love the fact that you just get 20 clues, of which 18 might be relevant. Mm. And then you end up following the two that aren't, of course, you know, how it's used. Which
yeah,
is,
I think that works really well. Yeah,
I think you did really well coping, setting it in a combat situation in Vietnam, you know.
I think that's where it started. I don't think it fell down, but it stumbled, certainly.
How much fancy footwork did you have to do behind the scenes then with as a GM for that combat when things were getting really quite busy towards the end there in Vietnam?
I mean, essentially, I tried to put as much information as I could up on Foundry. And so you could like look at it and say, oh, actually, I'll try and do suppressing fire. And that way you could read the rule. And I didn't have to. That was a big help. I mean, in the end, the story, for me, in this kind of campaign, the story is the thing.
Yeah.
So there were times when I would skate over a rule because I just couldn't face looking at the index one more time. And I don't, you know, the Fall of Delta Green Index is huge. And not always easy to navigate around. So if something was going to happen that looked a bit tricky, so usually I'd prep stuff in advance. So if I knew there was a chase coming up, I'd dig out the chase rules, write down my own version of them, simplify them a bit. But if something happened on the fly, yeah, it was a bit. Let's just say there was a healthy side order of fudge.
Yeah.
On some of the combats.
But the atmosphere was there. I wouldn't, you know, yeah. In no way did we feel that this was fudged, you know. I mean,
the system, though, I played Delta Green, well, sorry, Fall of Delta Green, I played Trail of Cthulhu, I played it's Black Agents. I quite enjoy it. I mean, it's not a system I would run myself. I think player, it kind of works really well. It's very simple. I love the idea of a game that works off a single D6. Do that and make it work. I think that's brilliant because I don't think there's many games that do that. But the system does what it needs to. It moves fast. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, you tell us. You know, you'd say things like, "Do you have any notice or whatever?" Yeah, and you know, does it need to spend? It was just really fast moving. When we came to do stuff that used general skills, we all knew how it worked. And I think it's probably worth saying, I'm sure, I don't know if you mentioned it, but the Foundry system for it looks really good. It made it very easy to work with. So I'd happily gumshoe anytime.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's a guy, Neil Descartes. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. I might not be. But he's done the gumshoe system on Foundry, and it is great. Really, really, really good. So can't fault that.
And I've found this in other games where, so like in Liminal, for example, it's almost like you don't really care about the combat. It's not about the combat, really. It's not a tactical combat game. You're interested in what the outcome is. So I think for me, it wasn't anything to do with your GM, Martin. It's just the way it is that a lot of those games, they sort of slide to a halt when you hit combat. So for me, if I was going to run Gumshoe in future, which, you know, I want to run Trail of Cthulhu, I'd probably use the Quick Shock system because that is essentially how much are you willing to put in as players in, how many points do you want to put into a combat or a conflict? It doesn't have to be a combat to get an outcome. And there's three or four rocks and that's it. It's done. And so you move to what's the outcome of that combat? What's the result for the players? Are they injured? Are they whatever it might be? And with Foundry version 9, it's got card support in there. So all the quick shot cards, you can build them in. So
I've got no idea about quick shot. So
It's in the Yellow King. I recommend it. You can. I'll get into RuneQuest next.
All right. I would also work with a narrative system like Quest Worlds, where Quest Worlds you basically abstract combat to a roll to a multiple 1d20. You know, so
Neil's shaking his head.
Relevant for each side, and then you just make the roll and narrate the result.
I want to earn my smashing things teeth.
Well, another thing I thought I might want to speak about is character death. Those of us who, like, we're old hands at Cthulhu, there was almost a kind of perverse sort of I Spy Book of Cthulhu deaths. But he was torn apart by a Shoggoth. Oh, he blew himself up with his own dynamite. You know, you look forward to that. Whereas I felt the character deaths, I think, that happened in this campaign were quite profound.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
So I wondered if you want to take ourselves through our various...
characters' demises. Characters, yeah. Demise. And I think it's because we live with the characters for a long time. I think it was only Carter, so Andrew's character, made it all the way through. So Weissmuller, I mean, he went through a bit of a real sorry downward spiral where it was inevitable that it was going to happen, so you could see it coming. He basically got subsumed by this plant, this parasitic plant. And in my head, it was in Saigon and the river. And we'd gone to investigate some horrific hellhole that was sort of, you know, like on stilts out over the river. And that was where he met his end. And he just sort of slid slowly under the waves. He gave up. I mean, spoilers, he did come back at the end as an NPC.
Or did he?
Come back, yeah.
Something came back, but what was it?
So it was really downbeat, and it was quite, there's no heroism to that at all. I think
that's something the stability system in Fall of Delta Green does do really well. And I think Neil mentioned this when we were playing. It becomes exponential. You're spending stability to try and stay stable. You're basically writing checks that you can't cash. And all of a sudden, it's like that. I think you said this, Steve, that whole the analogy with bankruptcy. You go bankrupt very slowly, then you go bankrupt very quickly.
That's right.
I mean, that's stability in Fall of Delta Green as well. And I think you're right. So you had one of the things about it is that you know your character's going to go. Yeah. You're maybe not sure exactly when. So, like, I think Carter did survive, but there was a couple of times when he was on very thin ice.
Oh, definitely.
But, like, what Kay's character, Wyatt, and Holly, there came a point when I think both of you realised they're not going to come out of this.
Yeah.
And I thought that made it, rather than the kind of, oh, look, he's fallen on his own dynamite, that made it a more profound experience because you probably knew something bad was coming up.
It's interesting because I think for Kay, and I'm sure Kay will speak on it, it you know, you could see Wyatt, again, unfurling over a few seconds. Whereas to me, it felt like Holly was kind of, he was holding it together. He was still very much like in the game. And then just, I don't know if it was that one session, the session before, it's that bit you said about, you know, it's just very slowly you start to lose your stability. And then all of a sudden, once you get below zero, you've got nothing to spend. You got like a 50% chance, you know, if it's something really bad, it's even less of a chance to. And all of a sudden you just go, boom, like right down. And then that's it. And you do bad rolls then. Game over, man. Yeah.
Yeah. And obviously, like you touched upon Kay, Wyatt. And I think, and Kay mentioned like earlier about how the investment you had in Wyatt. And I think you could see the way you played Wyatt that certainly in Saigon, she'd started to get more reckless.
Yeah. And making those kind of bad life choices, because it did start off with excessive drinking and smoking and being even more surly than usual. And then it went into some poor life choices. And then by the time her stability had gone right down, I had that wonderful little chart that I've been trying to find. I can't find my roll table anymore because I thought, well, she is unstable. The whole point of stability is that when it goes, you have to be unpredictable. So I had a little roll table of 1 to 6 where there would be a different kind of attitude. And it was all things like, you know, game over, man, was one of the attitudes where she'd just be kind of catatonic. And I tried to make it like the stages of grief, in that there would be sort of anger, bargaining, acceptance, and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, yeah. So the idea is that you wouldn't know if she'd react angrily or whether she'd make some poor life choices or whether she'd just clam up or whether she'd just go in guns blazing. You know, you wouldn't know. And so I literally did roll a D6 to see what her reaction would be on this table as she lost her stability and became unpredictable. And that was absolutely fantastic to play. And then, of course, you know, at the end, it all kind of disappeared. I think it was when she finally clapped eyes on the MIGO?
MIGO, yeah.
That's right, yeah.
And that's it. You know, the last of her sanity disappeared. And I knew that she was going to die this session, but I didn't know what to do with it, because in previous games when characters have died, it's been like a heroic last stand or something. It hasn't just been something as banal as seeing another weird thing after seeing a whole load of weird things. So at this point, and I'd gone through all kinds of things about what she would do, but I wanted to get back with something with her backstory. So her backstory was that she'd lost her husband. Her husband, you know, she was a widow, and you know, some years ago, and that she would have. She would, having gone completely crazy, just kind of perceive him somewhere off in the mist, that he's calling to her to join him. And so she took her own life. But that was quite a snap decision for her to just sort of take out the gun and just take her own life there and there. And afterwards, I spent the whole night going, I've done a horrible social faux pas. This is really uncomfortable. I've probably triggered like half of the team. They're all going to think that I'm really overly dramatic. But it was just like, it was one of those things where she... I'd role-played her as being so unpredictable for so long that I couldn't even work out what she would do.
Yeah, I think we'd shared that decline, though. Yes, it was a shock. And certainly me as GM, I was like, ooh.
Yeah, because your face on the camera, and I did, yeah, and I was like, wow, is this like the worst thing I've ever done as a player? And I'm still not 100% sure that was a good call. It was just one of those things where you just don't know how you're going to react until you're actually there, and you can plan all you like. But you just, and it wasn't like super emotional for me. It wasn't like oh, well, screw you guys. She's just going to kill herself there and then. It was I wanted it to be sort of bittersweet and a little bit shocking because I wanted her to go in a way that was memorable. But I'm not sure I quite got it right as a player.
Yeah, it's shocking because it always is when those sort of things happen. But it wasn't it was shocking because it had happened, not because, and we hadn't seen it coming, but it emerged out of what happened in play. And I think, with Holly, the way he went out. So if you want to say what Holly did, Neil.
Yeah. So it was actually the same point that Wyatt, it was just an overload of, stability loss, and I think some sanity as well. And so he again, knowing he was going to go, because Martin said to us, you know, to me and Kay, you know, have a think about how your characters are going to go. So I was thinking Holly was, he was a soldier, he was in Korea, he's probably, you know, crawling around trenches or wherever, or, you know, some really unpleasant stuff. And so he just had a flashback, major flashback, and he saw this guy go, you know, something that needs to be taken down. And he just, I mean, he's saying the dynamite thing, but I think it was a grenade. I don't know. Maybe
dynamite. There's a whole bunch of grenades, I think, wasn't it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, it was the...
grenade launcher. You kept firing as you ran towards it, basically.
Yeah, just kind of ran right up to it and rammed it into the thing and blew it up. And it's great because it didn't even need to, like, there was no, like, you need to roll to see if you can hit.
It just fitted.
And it happens.
So if we think about the three sort of main character deaths, wasn't it, really? I mean, Cthulhu, for me, is you've the futility of raging against this uncaring universe. And because essentially, although obviously Holly took out one of the Migo, but, you know, I'm sure it reformed somewhere on Pluto or whatever it is at some point. But essentially, what happens...
You never win against the mythos.
But essentially, all of the character deaths, they were not heroic. They were just... futile, and that sounds really, really downbeat, but I think it fitted with the whole sort of the tenor of the game, you know.
It is a downbeat game, definitely.
But great. Yeah, fantastic stuff. So
it's kind of weird because obviously Carter was the only one that survived. Now Carter was designed to be quite cold and emotionless, you know. He was literally a CIA kind of assassin. But for some reason, the dice seemed to support that. He did lose stability. But every time you had to make a vital roll, he would just roll a six. Dice supported the character. You know, it was... Had he rolled a one or something, he'd have gone about equally batshit crazy as any of the other characters. Yeah. He never did. He just somehow always the dice supported him, you know, which was... a really bizarre kind of, you know.
I mean, should we talk about something more lighthearted to finish? the bit that just really got me laughing and is the Howard Hughes bit.
Yeah, the Howard Hughes bit.
I mean, I'd laid the foundations for that particular red herring long and hard, and for me that was one of the payoffs where you actually, I'm not saying it was a railroad, but you went along the tracks like a dream. And so that there was a lot of kind of, I thought that was my sort of most lighthearted moment. Right?
That was great.
But it wasn't just funny; it was super entertaining as well. Really, really. Great bit of the game
and very like cinematic. I think that's what I liked about the Vegas section. I think it was there was a lot of visuals in there. Yeah,
The Vegas section was very cinematic, definitely. I think, you know, we could all picture ourselves doing what we were doing, you know, in Vegas, definitely. I think
that's what I was going to say. The kind of dressing up stuff that when Carter and Wyatt were trying to find out about that mob boss who was running the casino when we auditioned, didn't we? We did the audition, and so I was on vocals and you were on piano, and the dice rolls were just superb. We nailed that audition, and it was just so perfect to think that, you know, we ridiculously weird, brutal, murderous, slightly weird and broken FBI, CIA types.
It was a real sliding doors moment. You could have got a Vietnam, and never gone to Vietnam.
Oh, if only.
We left Delta Green following our number one album.
Fantastic. Yeah. I mean, for me, well, the comedy point was the Keystone Cops in the temple when we were all sort of setting each other up, saying, you know, because Neil, I think Neil, your character was my character's uncle. And then, you know, I think Andrew was going to be my brother-in-law. So we set this whole backstory up, and it was going to all end in tragedy, but we just did it on the fly. And that was, we were laughing all the way through that one. All right. For me, it's certainly one of the high points of my sort of gaming career, if you like. And it's been very rich. And so I really enjoyed that. I think, you know, it'd be difficult to top that, certainly from a Delta Green side of things. Thanks to Martin for ably GMing and putting all the work into it. And also to you guys for, you know, being fellow travellers on the journey to an untimely, unpleasant end.
Yeah.
So
big cheers for Martin.
Hip hooray! Hooray!
There you go. And I'd say thanks to you guys as well. I mean, fantastic players. Thanks to Adrian and Agent Pumpkin, Adrian Kelly and Agent Pumpkin on Twitter, who started and sadly couldn't carry on, but if they hadn't volunteered to start off, it wouldn't have started. So you owe them a debt as well.
Yeah, they were in the pilot. An episode.
Yeah, they were in the pilot.
Yeah, the pilot episode. Yeah,
good way of seeing it.
Then we decided we couldn't afford them, so.
That's right. They launched it, and then went on to got this piece.
Got really.
So that's a thank you. Actually, yeah. But it was great. It was great fun, and although at times I just it made me tear my hair out. The payoff has been really good, I think.
Fantastic.
I can put it to bed and say that was like a
you've done that
a
now.
A good thing was done, and like people got a lot of pleasure out of it. So
that's great.
That's why we do it.
Thanks very much, everybody.
No. Thank you, Steve. Thanks very much for indulging me. That's really lovely.
No, it's my pleasure. It's good to remember such fantastic gaming opportunities and experiences.
It's weird that we won't meet up again as a fall of Delta Green Tea, but there we are. I'll see you in whatever games I see you in next.
Subcommittee XCOM 989 Wing 5 Interagency Liaison Committee Memo Notes. Highest classification, 20-year rule applied. XCOM eyes only. Earliest release date, January 1st, 1988. Observations on ex-Delta Green agents. Mr. Secretary of State, the following is a summary of loose surveillance on several ex-Delta Green agents as per policy document 169XC43PAPA. Full surveillance records can be accessed through application to the Archive Division of the Annex. The following agents were involved with several operations which culminated in the prevention of an estimated Level 8 incursion in Vietnam. As an aside, Secretary, this, as far as we can ascertain, was the first Delta Green mission in Vietnam, and, unlike later Vengeance, was at least partially successful. Thank you for your time. Deputy Director Grumman Dexter. Record 1. Agent Logan Carter. Carter's unexpected aptitude for the practical application of hypergeometry as displayed in Phuoc Long Province in July 1963 led him being seconded to the Annex Archive. After much successful research, Carter was deployed as hypergeometry consultant in Operations Medal, Tokyo 1964, Night Watchman, Chicago 1966, and Cosmos, Space 1966. Carter disappeared, literally, during Operation Sasquatch, Oregon 1967. At the end, Carter had no family ties and had prevailed upon the CIA to have him recorded as missing in action. A true patriot, he was a linchpin in America's hypergeometric defense for nearly 4 years, well above the standard operating period for men in his position. Record 2. Private Charles Chip Kowalski. Chip returned from Phuoc Long province remarkably stable. As a reward for exemplary service in extraordinary conditions, he was given a full honourable discharge and awarded the Distinguished Service Cross. He returned home to his farm via New Orleans, where he briefly visited the family of Aja Linda Wyatt, deceased. Currently a successful farmer and family man, he has a wife, Jean, and four daughters, Linda, Penelope, Catherine, and Maisie. He was later tracked down by the cable news channel show History of Weird Wars. When asked about his Vietnam experiences, he simply replied, "Well, I wouldn't know anything about that." Interestingly, of all the survivors of Operation Faux Pas, Kowalski was the only one who regained color to his skin and hair. Record 3. Sergeant Marvin Mad Dog Lee Hancock. Like Kowalski, Hancock returned to the USA with an honorable discharge and a Distinguished Service Cross. He went back to his mobile home outside of Las Vegas in 1967. Later, Delta Green required his services and sent two agents to pursue him to volunteer. Taped to the door of his mobile home was a sun-bleached note reading, "Gone hunting." His current whereabouts are unknown. Record 4. Private Marlon Snooze Zemecki. Zemecki used his medal and discharge to get himself a GI loan and started an experimental jazz quartet. His music became a big hit on the underground scene, weaving as it did traditional jazz with a distinctly Eastern mystic and otherworldly sound. Audience reported almost psychedelic experiences when hearing what he called the music of the universe. In 1980, he was offered a lucrative contract by the Zan agency to go on a long tour. As yet, he has not returned to the United States. Private Zal Prof. Weinstock forms Record 5. On his return to the U.S., Weinstock quickly became heavily involved in the hippie movement and went on several anti-war protests. In 1969, he joined the Astral Phenomena Research Organization, or APRO, a UFO research group that stressed scientific field investigations and had a large staff of consulting PhD scientists, as well as field men like Weinstock. He also published Weird War Stories, a magazine which picked up on a lot of the strange stories that soldiers had brought home from Vietnam. In 1985, he found the cable TV channel Look to the Skies, and is still its CEO and president. Record 6, Dr. Marc Boubois. On his return from Vietnam, Boubois had a fractious relationship with Delta Green. He refused to help catalog samples he had collected unless he was given access to some of the annexes, most advanced reading room catalog. This request was granted, and Boubois became an enthusiastic student of hypergeometry, although did not have the innate practical ability displayed by Carter. One final confrontation with the annex's head of library security resulted in Boubois' privileges being revoked, upon which he disappeared. As a high-level asset, U.S. agencies were put on high alert and eventually discovered him in Rome, working for the Vatican Collection. In 1980, after a ferocious storm in downtown Rome, he disappeared and has not been seen since. Memo ends.
Thanks for listening to another exploration of my gaming vexes. If you've got any thoughts you'd like to add to what you've heard here, or a gaming vex of your own you'd like to offer up for discussion, you can contact me on Twitter at AllAnthar, or you can leave a voice message. The link's on the podcast webpage on Anchor, or can be found in the show notes. Until the next time, may all your games be free of vexatiousness, and be excellent to each other, always.